The First Testament lesson today is from Genesis chapter 27, verses 1 through 17. You can follow along in your pew Bible on page 23 of the Old Testament. Listen for the word of the Lord. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called his elder son Esau and said to him, "My son," and he answered, "Here I am." He said, "See, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. Then prepare for me savory food, such as I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may bless you before I die." Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I heard your father say to your brother Esau, 'Bring me game and prepare for me savory food to eat, that I may bless you before the Lord before I die.' Now therefore, my son, obey my word as I command you. Go to the flock and get me 2 choice kids, so that I may prepare for them savory food for your father, such as he likes. And you shall take it to your father to eat, so that he may bless you before he dies." But Jacob said to his mother Rebekah, "Look, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am a man of smooth skin. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall seem to be mocking him and bring a curse on myself and not a blessing." His mother said to him, "Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my word and go and get them for me." So he went and got them and brought them to his mother. And his mother prepared savory food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of her elder son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them on her younger son Jacob. And she put the skins of the kids on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. Then she handed the savory food and the bread that she had prepared to her son Jacob. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
We turn our attention now to our New Testament lesson that this week comes out of the Gospel of Matthew. Now, for those of you who have been here off and on through the summer, we've been staying mainly in Romans, but today we're jumping to Matthew because this text really sort of helps fill out what I was talking about last week. It's a great illustration. And so we're going to read the first 6 verses, then we're going to jump down to verse 10. Let us listen for the word of the Lord. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" He called the child whom he put among them and said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes humble like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. If any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believe in me, it would be better for you if a great millstone were fastened around your neck and you were drowned in the depth of the sea." And now to verse 10. "Take care that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I tell you, in heaven, their angels continually see the face of my Father in heaven. What do you think? If a shepherd has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I tell you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So, it is not the will of your Father in heaven that one of these little ones should be lost." The word of the Lord.
I've often thought that if sort of aliens ever descended from outer space and decided to do a sociological study of especially the United States, I wondered if they would wonder if the only thing we ever do is create top 10 lists. Now let me ask, how many of you have seen a top 10 list in the last week? That's right, newspaper, web. I mean, we have top 10 lists for everything. We have top 10 lists for, obviously, every sport that has ever been invented. We have top 10 lists of the best-looking people. Never made the list. We have lists of the best-dressed people. Didn't make that one either. We have lists of the top 10 richest people, richest families, richest counties. We have top 10 lists of the best colleges and universities. How many of your universities have the top 10 list? Ah, see, there you go. We're on the top. And then there's a list that no one wants their school to make, and that is the top 10 party schools. Yes, so someone's like, yes, that's my school. Okay, well, there you go. Someone wants to claim it. But for me, what this says is that there is something about human nature where we are, I hear the hum, where we are competitive. That there is almost something hardwired about us that makes us competitive. Ever since we pushed the Neanderthals off the top of the food chain of bipedal species and we took over, we've been it. And we've been competing with each other ever since. We've competed for land, we've competed for food, we've competed for power, we've competed for position. That we have this deep and profound need to be number one, to be at the top of the heap. And so it would seem to make sense then that in this book there are tons of stories of people who are competing. And both of our texts for the morning have that as the center of what's going on. So our Old Testament text, we have Esau and Jacob. Now Rebekah, their mother, gave birth to Esau and Jacob, who were twins. Esau came down the chute first, and so he's number one. He gets the blessing, he gets the inheritance, he gets everything. Jacob, on the other hand, is number two, and he gets nothing. Now, Esau was Dad's favorite, because he was a manly man. He went out and killed things. I mean, that's why he's his father's favorite. Jacob, on the other hand, he's his mom's favorite. He hangs out at home. He learns to be a sous chef. He's always there, and so mom loves him best. And so the story is that Rebekah conspires with Jacob to lie, cheat, and steal the blessing because she wants her favorite to be number one. Now, our second story has to do with the disciples. Now, I want to sort of set the stage for this story to make sure we really understand the position in which the disciples find themselves. The disciples are all from Galilee. Okay? Galilee was a backwater burg. It was a place where if you came from there, people humiliated you and made fun of you. People had this saying that nothing good can come out of Galilee. They were oppressed by the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem. They were oppressed by the Romans. These disciples had been so knocked down that the only way to go was up. And so they hitch their wagon to Jesus. And in Jesus, they thought they saw the ticket up. And so finally, after they'd been on the road for a while with Jesus, they come up to him and they said, okay, Jesus, who's greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Now, chances are, the answer they were looking for was, why you? Who else? Now, it may be that they wanted Jesus to rank order them 1 through 12, and then they could compete to see who would be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. But regardless, Jesus' answer would have stunned them. This is what he says. He calls over a child, and he puts the child in the middle of them and says, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes humble like this child will be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Now understand clearly, in the first century, children, well, let me put it this way. There's no word in Greek for little boy or little girl. There's only a neutral word for child. In other words, children are its. They aren't little boys. They aren't little girls. They are nothing. They are simply another mouth to feed until they get old enough to help in the shop or in the workroom or in the fields. And in this point in time, if someone had too many girl children, the practice was if your wife gave birth to another child, a girl child, you would take it out and set it out to die. Because you couldn't afford to feed this child, you couldn't afford the dowry to have this child married. So when Jesus puts this child in the middle of them and says, "This is what you're supposed to be. If you want to become greatest in the kingdom, you have to be as humble as this little child." Stunned. Stunned. And my guess is sometimes, though we're not stunned by it, because after all, that's one thing we in the church preach. Well, we're all supposed to be humble. We're all supposed to be vulnerable, like a little child, like the child that Jesus put in the middle of the disciples. We sort of nod our head and go, because we don't really want to believe it. And I think the reason we don't want to believe it is that the image is that humility and vulnerability bring up are not ones we really like, okay? Because if you talk about humility, it means we're supposed to say things like this. "Oh, I know I'd be really perfect for that job and the raise that goes with it, but, you know, I'm just a humble Christian. Why didn't you give it to Frank in the other cubicle? He needs it more than I do." Or vulnerability. We're supposed to print out on our computers a sign that says, "Hi, I'm a Christian, kick me," you know, and put it on our backs because, after all, we're to be humble and vulnerable. So the question becomes then, what does Jesus really mean by this? What does he really intend by being humble and vulnerable like a child? What I want to offer to you this morning is that what Jesus wants is for us to be like him, like Jesus. Because if you want to see the model of someone who is humble and vulnerable, Jesus is it. And by the way, he doesn't have a sign on his back saying, "Kick me." He knows very clearly who he is. So what does it mean then to be humble and vulnerable as Jesus did? I believe what it means is that we are willing, we choose to stand with the vulnerable and marginalized in our society and in the world. Because that's what Jesus did. And when I say stand with, that's what I mean. Because so often our tendency with the vulnerable in the world is that we want to sort of be, you know, Mighty Mouse messiahs. "Here I come to save the day." You know, we swoop in and we take care of people. But that's not how Jesus did it. Okay? Or sometimes it's kind of like the patron, the man who runs the big plantation, and he says, "Well, ordinary people, peons, let me give you some things from the bounty of my table. Let me offer you a little something, but know clearly that I'm really better than you." It's not what Jesus did either. Jesus ate with sinners and tax collectors. He hung out with prostitutes, with gluttons and drunkards. He stood with the poor, the marginalized, those whom society had driven to the edges. And he was with them. They felt as if this man cared deeply enough about them to share their life with them. And he made them believe that not only did he love and care for them, but that God did. See, that's the ultimate in humility, when the Son of God can be so with people that they feel like he is their friend, that he is someone who is their equal and he cares about them. That is humility. That is vulnerability. Because what happens is, when you stand with the people on the margins of society, there are a lot of people who don't like it. They like the walls being drawn. They like that we're in and they're out. They like that we're number one and they're number 123. They like this fact that to build themselves up, they have to put others down and keep them down. And you look at Jesus' life, and every time he reached out to those, he was under attack and under criticism. That's the vulnerability. The year was 1977. The place was the nation of El Salvador. The bishop had grown old enough to need to retire, and the archbishop, and so they needed to name a new archbishop. And so the powers that be in Rome looked down at all the bishops of El Salvador, and they chose the most conservative bishop who was there. And his choice was, it stunned the parish priests and the nuns who worked with the poor and the marginalized, because he had edited an ultra-conservative Catholic newspaper that had made it clear that his belief was the church had no business dealing in issues of poverty and in issues of justice, that they were there to save the souls of the people, and that was all. But then something happened. 3 weeks after his installation, one of his best friends, a priest who had been under him when he was a bishop, was gunned down on a country road. He was gunned down along with an elderly man who was his friend and a young boy, the grandson of the man. And when the archbishop went out to the funeral, to do the funeral mass for his friend, and he looked at this man and he looked at the hundreds of peasants who had come to celebrate the life of this man that they had lost, he said, "If this man died for what he is doing, then I need to walk the same road." And Archbishop Oscar Romero became a different man. He began to speak out about poverty and injustice. He began to speak out about the right-wing death squads. And not a week went by when his life wasn't threatened by someone. But he believed that to be humble and vulnerable like Christ was to be like his friend, Father Grande. It was to be like Jesus Christ. It was to stand with those whom society had forgotten. And then 3 years later, in 1980, he'd given a speech calling on the army not to kill the peasants, not to kill the vulnerable. And he went to celebrate Mass, and he was assassinated. The civil war that raged in El Salvador took the lives of 70,000 people, and among them were dozens of priests and nuns and church workers. They were killed because they stood with the poor, with the marginalized. They stood with them as Christ stands with us. And so the question for all of us is, with whom will we stand? Will we stand with the children in Detroit and Pontiac whose education is less than stellar? Will we stand like youth in the inner city who need job training in order to make a living to support themselves and their families? Will we stand with foster children who often get shoved from home to home and then at 18 get ejected from the system? Will we stand with our brothers and sisters in Mexico whose health care is far less than it ought to be? Will we stand with the children and parents in Kenya who have no access to clean water? Will we stand with those who have been demonized and profiled and discriminated against for any number of reasons? Will we stand with these people who have been shoved to the edges of life and society? With whom will we stand? Because that's the question, that if we are to be like this little child, humble and vulnerable, will we be like Jesus Christ who stood with the poor and the needy and the outcast? If we are to be like them, who will we stand with? And so my question to you on this morning is this. This is what I challenge you to do. That as you come to the table and take the sacraments, take the symbols of Christ's body and blood shed for us because He stood with us, that when you do that, to ask yourself, with whom will I stand that I might live in imitation of Jesus Christ, who stood and always will stand with me? Let us pray. Loving God, we give you thanks for the gift of your Son, Jesus Christ, for the gift of people like Father Grande and Oscar Romero and so many others who stood with the poor and the marginalized. Give us the courage to do the same now and always. In Christ's name, amen.